Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Radio Hour. Today, a continuation of our ongoing series, Climate Change. This particular segment, Realistic Projections of Climate Change and Global Warming and Sensible Constructive Responses. My two panelists, Dr. Guy McPherson, a professor emeritus of Natural Resources Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, University of Arizona. He has specialized in forest resources, energy decline, and climate change, and its economic consequences. In the past, he has also taught at Texas A&M University, University of California, Berkeley. Having become disillusioned with the American university environment and academia, he has decided best to share his message with individuals in a more progressive form. He is the author of several books, the latest co-written with Carolyn Baker, entitled Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. He also is the co-host of the radio program Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. And that is heard every Tuesday evening or afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. His website is guymcpherson.com. He is joined from Ottawa, Canada, by Professor Paul Beckwith. Dr. Beckwith has an extensive background also at the Laboratory of Paleoclimatology and Climatology, University of Ottawa in Ontario, where he also teaches there. And Paul's research specializes in abrupt effects for climate change, such as tornadoes and the rise of more fierce tropical storms and greenhouse gas emissions, and the global implications of the melting Arctic ice sheets, and the social media for climate change advocacy. He is a member and participant in the Arctic Methane Emergency Group and the Canadian Meteorological and Oceanographic Society. His website is paulbeckwith.net. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Yes, thank you, Gary.
I'd like to ask a series of shorter questions because we have so much terrain to cover, and ask if you would both give more succinct replies. Normally, we do not limit how long a person takes on this program, but we have a lot of ground to cover. Over the years, I brought on the program many climate scientists, geophysicists, and environmental scholars and activists, and with few exceptions, such as yourself, I find that very few people are willing to go out on that limb and tell us what the worst-case scenario is and about the speed and impacts of the climate change underway. Now, I realize there is no single scenario regarding climate change forecast, either optimistic or pessimistic, that is conclusive. But I do know we're now in chaos theory. There is still considerable subjectivity with interpreting data, and then we must realize that the science and research and results are constantly evolving and changing. Nevertheless, we want to take away the filters. We know that when we ask any official government agency to give us an honest projection, first and foremost, they're giving us part of that answer through a political spectrum. Then they're also, without our knowledge or consent, they also have alliances, front groups, foundations, and many of these are funded by the very polluters out there who are never held accountable. But we don't see them. And we don't even know many times when the spokesperson on a national show or in a magazine is being paid to project a certain idea. Let me just give you an example. I have been explaining to my radio audience in California for more than 10 years that there is a time in the future, and this was 10 years ago, when California would no longer be a sustainable oasis that it has been for the last better than 75 to 100 years. You'll have more people with a higher standard of living. You'll have more agriculture with greater need for rare and non-replenishable resources. And you'll have a greater need because these people and living there and the industries, they pay the taxes, and those taxes then go to fund all of the bureaucracies, some needed, some excessive, some redundant. But those bureaucracies can only do what they're supposed to do if they're funded. And if a governor were to be honest and say at least 75% of the state is no longer in the future sustainable, we simply do not have the water, we are having massive drought, and then when we have water, it's frequently flooding, like currently with El Nino. And also, we're on an earthquake fault line, San Andreas Fault. And north of that is even a more precarious one. We have two nuclear facilities that, if this earthquake occurs, could be damaged, in which case that would put a lot of people, at least 20 million people in California, at risk of radiation exposure. And the ocean is rising. So I would suggest that you begin to look in the near future at relocating to a more sustainable and hospitable environment. California had its day, but now it's gone. If a governor said that, they would be booed out of office, thrown out of office. The people would be angry because people have invested their life savings in their gated community homes. They don't want to move. Now those gated communities, many of them, they don't have a lake to look out on. It's dry. They don't have a golf course. It's either been painted green, which doesn't allow you to play golf, or it's gone back to its natural color, faded. So now there is an exodus out of the state. But that's just one example of people who could be honest but aren't. Now think of all the people who live at the ocean. Think of the people in Miami and Wilmington and Washington, D.C. and New York City and other places that inevitably will flood. We're not told that. We're told it's way off in the distance. In fact, I even had a gentleman on this series who said that the oceans are only rising what would be equivalent of 3 dimes, 3 10-cent pieces, if you stack them on top of each other. And so it would take you 100 years for the water to rise 0.5 foot. And therefore, what's the bother? Why pay attention? It's not now. It's not an emergency. So would you both address this idea? Do you believe we're getting honest, objective, and fair information from the authorities, from the scientists, so those of us who do care could prepare ourselves in a reasonable way without panicking for the next change in our lives?
Do you want me to go first?
Yes.
Okay. The short answer is we're getting nothing close to the reality of the situation from politicians, from most scientists, from the media. I mean, there are niches on the internet, in Facebook, that understand much closer the reality of the situation, but it's certainly not out there to the general public. I mean, you have to go and look for the site, and you have to go do some digging yourself to find out what's really happening. In a nutshell, I mean, I think we're undergoing abrupt climate change. The warming in the Arctic is extremely large compared to the global average temperature. And if you compare it to the equator, which is the important comparison, the equator doesn't change much, hasn't been rising in temperature much. The Arctic's warming at least 5 to 8 tons faster, even more than when you compare that rate to the equator. So this is lowering the temperature difference between the Arctic and the equator, which causes the jet streams to slow down and become wavy, causing extreme weather events. And we're rapidly losing sea ice and snow cover in the Arctic. In fact, it would not be surprising if we had a so-called blue ocean event by 2020 or earlier, when there's absolutely no sea ice in the Arctic at the end of the melt season, which would be, say, in September. And with that type of situation, with an ocean much darker, there's much more absorption of sunlight, so there's a lot more heating, so the system sort of cascades up into a large amount of warming, and within a few years the sea ice is gone for several months of the year, and within a decade it's probably gone year round. And of course the ocean warming releases more and more methane from the seafloor and also from the permafrost on land. And we're basically in an abrupt climate situation. Melt rates from Greenland would skyrocket due to the warming Arctic. We're in the soup here. You know, it's happening now. I mean, there's no need to talk about the future. You know, these things are happening now, and we're seeing extreme weather events taking off around the planet.
Could you be more specific, please? Because again, it's not in the kind of context most people can understand. First, if most people are not living near the ocean, they may not be aware of ocean level rise. I was recently told by one guest that it will take at least 100 years before anyone would even notice it. And yet when I was in Miami, I lived in Miami Beach, had a place for 15 years. Only in the last 3 years did I see at nighttime how far up the tidal surge was. It was coming almost 100 feet further towards the street than what it had earlier. Why it was doing this, but it was consistent. And then I said, it's happening. By this definition of seeing this with your own eyes, going down to Key Largo, there's some streets there that are flooded all year with as much as 18 inches of water, which creates a terrible smell and mosquitoes. That's the new reality. So are we talking about this year, next year, 10 years, 20 years? When do you think, based upon the feedback loops that could start to collapse, and then there would be nothing holding them back? And you mentioned Greenland. Give us an idea of what could happen in Greenland, or what is happening now.
Okay, so the melt rate of ice from both Greenland and Antarctica, which is ice sitting on land, so when it melts, it raises sea level, and sea level is also rising from the expansion of water at higher temperatures. Those melt rates are doubling in rate every 5 to 7 years. And this has happened over the last 20 years at least. So this is 3 or 4 doubling periods. So if this doubling period continues for both Greenland and Antarctica, you can easily calculate that we're talking about a sea level rise of something like 7 meters by 2070. So 5 meters of that would be by 2050 or so. If we do lose the sea ice in the summer in the Arctic, say this decade, you know, within the next 5 years, then that will clearly ramp up the melt rate from Greenland even more, because now the seawater is much, much warmer, and it undercuts the ice both in Greenland and actually in Antarctica as well. So, I mean, the mass loss from Antarctica, that all that is occurring, not from surface melt, but from warm seawater undercutting the ice. The ice is sitting on bedrock, which is well below sea level. Greenland alone has about 7 meters of global sea level rise built into it. Antarctica divided into west and east, and west Antarctica has about 5 meters, and east has the rest, giving it a total of about 70 meters of sea level rise if everything was to go. So we're talking about exponential changes, and we do see mechanisms to continue this exponential rise in sea level because of the greatly warming Arctic. And we're not even talking about methane releases significantly affecting things. If you add in the methane wild card, if we get large pulses or burps of methane coming from the Arctic, and the levels are rising now, but if we get a massive release of methane, say 50 gigatons to the atmosphere over the space of a year or 10 years, it's been modeled by Peter Wadhams, and there's like a $70 trillion cost to the economy, and it would basically, you know, the planet would basically warm 5 or 6 degrees in a decade or two. And even if the methane does not come up in a big way, it's huge excursions of cold air from the Arctic to lower latitudes that we're seeing, and the huge excursions of warm air from warm and humid air from lower latitudes up into the Arctic are, both of those things are causing a great warming of the Arctic, which is accelerating. And often, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we see really large regions of the Arctic that are 20 degrees or Celsius or more warmer than the norm. So the system has destabilized. There's no question. And Paris is the goal of Paris is just to reduce emissions. But that's I like to use the analogy of a three-legged bar stool. Zeroing emissions is only one leg. We also need to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. We also need to cool the Arctic to ensure that the methane doesn't come up and to try to get some, restore some semblance of stability to the weather systems, because all these extreme weather events, the increases in frequency, severity, and duration of extreme weather events is a direct result of the temperature amplification in the Arctic and the destabilization of the jet streams. So it all ties in together. You need to consider the overall climate system.
Okay, I would like to address this particular... Thank you. I appreciate the depth and breadth of your answer. I would like to address this question to Guy. If you take a look at the report from the Government Earth Science System Center that the Amazon rainforest has degraded to the point where it has lost its ability to regulate weather systems benignly as it has in the past, mainly because of logging and the uncontrolled land burning is being accused of the reason for this. And this has raised warnings about the start of a desertification of the Amazon basin. What are the larger implications of this trend that we should be most worried about with respect to the climate change and warming projections?
Well, we're talking about the lungs of the planet here. That's the label that has been put on the Amazon rainforest, the lungs of the planet. And we're talking about removing those lungs by destroying the trees that are there, destroying the extensive, incredibly complex forests that have been there for tens of thousands of years. So that's one of many self-reinforcing feedback loops that you start destroying the ability of trees to take up carbon dioxide and also cause them to emit carbon dioxide even faster through respiration and ultimately through decomposition when they die. That's one of these classic self-reinforcing feedback loops. The faster it goes, the warmer the climate becomes, and the warmer the climate becomes, the faster we destroy the lungs of the planet. So that's one of many, many causes for concern. As Paul pointed out, we are in the midst of abrupt climate change right now. This is something completely different than we've been negotiating about, arguing about, quibbling about for the last few decades. That was regular old linear-style climate change. We're now in the midst of abrupt climate change. It's an event that has historical precedents. It has happened in Earth's history before, and it appears that there is no way for humans to stop it.
Guy, how about the other trends in global desertification, particularly in China, the Middle East, the American Southwest, India, and Africa? When taken collectively, because this involves a vast amount of the planet's landmass and population, and in the worst-case scenario, how do you perceive desertification as a threat to the food security for a growing global population, because there will be areas where, well, quite simply, it will be too hot for growing seeds that have already adapted to earlier climate? I've seen it. I've seen it at my home where loquat, a fruit, normally, they are harvested in March. They come in 1st of March, and they have about 2 to 3 weeks lifespan. Now they're coming in January and August. Never before have I seen that. I'm seeing other things happen as well because of the sustained heat of the soil. And we're going to see right now in Kansas major drought adversely affecting the crops there, including corn and wheat. We're also seeing in South Dakota a difficulty with some of the crops there. We're seeing in Deaf Smith County that grows brown rice, for example, and other food stocks, including cotton, disruptions. Now, that's just here in the United States. So if you're wealthy enough to not be concerned about the source of your food nor the cost of your food, then you'll be able to get whatever you want because someone is growing it around the world and will get it to you for market, supply and demand. But what if you're one of the 275 people living in the United States who are food challenged? They just don't have the money. 18 million hungry children. Then what if you're the 1.3 billion right now, as we speak in the world, who are food challenged, and you can't live any longer where you're at because the soil is too dry or nutrient deficient or some other cause? You have to move. It's estimated this year there'll be 60 million refugees because of climate. That is not the same as the refugees because of civil war in Libya and Yemen and other countries. This is a whole different ballgame. And these people historically have been able to have some form of subsistence living. Not now. So would you take us, Guy, as a follow-up on the larger issue? When we look around the world, we're looking at China that has one of the fastest desertifications in the world. They're losing, I believe last year, it was something like 12,000 communities gone. The desert took it back. And they haven't paid attention to that, nor did they pay attention to the quality of their water. So 50% of all their rivers are not to be used for anything, not even irrigation. And now they're finally paying a little bit of attention to their environment. But look at the consequences of over 1 million people dying in China just from coal alone, pollution in the north of China, plus those living who will ultimately have some form of heart disease or lung disease because of living in Beijing and other cities are extremely polluted. So take us on that journey as well now, please.
Yeah, there are so many signs of abrupt climate change at this point. Climate refugees are fleeing areas that no longer harbor habitat for humans, and here we're talking about Syrians seeking shelter in Europe. The refugee crisis has gone global with recent examples in Mexico, the South Pacific, the Middle East, and Africa. We're seeing increasing evidence of rapidly spreading infectious diseases that kill thousands of people every year, and here we're thinking about things like malaria, dengue, Lyme, and more recently Zika. Wildfires that are too large and too numerous to control. Thinking about what's going on in Tasmania, Australia right now. Heat waves that kill thousands of people, Bangladesh and beyond. Disruptions in the supply of food and water, Syria and Sao Paulo, respectively. Extreme aridity causing a dust bowl that never ends. Central Africa, Asia, China, as you pointed out, southwestern United States. We're seeing superstorms that have the power to level cities. I mean, how much evidence do we need? And you pointed it out directly with your loquat example. And people who are growing food or are paying attention to the environment in which they are embedded have noticed. I get it all the time. When I travel, when I speak to people from other places, they say, I've been following you for a few years, and I thought abrupt climate change was for other people. I thought it was for some time in the future. But this year, for the first year ever, and I've been hearing this for a couple of years now, this year, for the first year ever, I can't grow any plants in my garden. My three varieties of grapes, early, middle, and late, all produced fruit in the early season. The same for the cherries. I can't produce arugula. They all bolted this year. And on the list goes. So if you're out there actually in the world, as you are, Gary, then of course you're going to notice. And there are a bunch of people who are out there in one way or another. It's, as you pointed out, the relatively wealthy people, the privileged people primarily in the global north, that can insulate themselves by still being able to take advantage of the world's reserve currency. But it's a disaster in many places already, and really abrupt climate change is just getting underway. We're at the beginning of the hockey stick, and things are going to get a lot worse before they get any better.
Appreciate that answer. Thank you. Paul, I interviewed Chris Shaw at Sussex University in the United Kingdom this week, and he takes issue with the 2 degrees Celsius figure as some kind of artificial barrier that suggests we're fine and all is well as long as we remain below that threshold. Now, both of you have indicated that it is feasible to reach 6 degrees Celsius in our lifetimes. So just describe what life would likely be like at 2 degrees and then 4 degrees and then finally at 6 degrees if humanity collectively doesn't do something radically now, revolutionary in concept, like a Marshall Plan for the environment. And tell us about this trajectory as you see it. And please address primarily the stresses that would be reached upon humans and other species, essential resources for survival, such as food and water?
Well, the Achilles heel of society is probably the, we all have to eat, we have to grow food. And when we get simultaneous extreme weather events, which take out crops globally, then there's huge trouble because prices will skyrocket, and people that are spending half of their income, for example, now on food, certainly, the prices double or triple, they're just completely out of luck. I mean, they won't be able to eat. They hit the streets. There'll be huge unrest. There's nothing that gets people out in the streets more than being hungry. You know, I've heard people say that we're about 3 days of meals away from, you know, riots in the streets at any given time. I mean, the idea, we're at 1 degree above pre-industrial now, and we're seeing this incredible disruption to the jet streams, which causes the incredible ramping up of extreme weather events. I mean, we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere and oceans with our emissions, and we're seeing the consequences because the planet has unequal heating. So I mean, 2 degrees is or 1 degree is a global average, but because the Arctic is much, much warmer, because it's darker and absorbing more solar energy, it does throw off the whole thermodynamics or the heat balance of the planet. The way the heat moves from the equator to the pole, it's in the atmosphere, about two-thirds in the atmosphere and a third's in the oceans. And the atmosphere, we've talked about the disruption to the jet streams, but the oceans are also, I mean, the ocean currents have switched, and it's become very obvious this year, and this is a new thing. We haven't seen this in previous years so much, but there's this massive cold pool says in Greenland. The Gulf Stream, which comes up the east coast of the U.S., is going slower. It's overriding the continental shelf. It's causing large sea level rise off the east coast of the U.S. In fact, 2009-2010, we had about a 5-inch rise just in that 1 year because of the warmer water. And this is only, you know, right now at 1 degree. I mean, if you look at December this year compared to December, previous Decembers were about 1.5 degrees, but this is because of the strong El Nino on top of climate change. But to contemplate, you know, 1.5 and 2 degrees, there's going to be complete disruption to our society. And if you go higher to, you know, 3-4 degrees, I mean, there's not many scientists that think that civilization can possibly survive, you know, a temperature rise of that much. And that's if it happens over a long period of time. But we're talking about these possible rises happening in over a decade or two. So how do we possibly adapt? I mean, most people, you know, vast parts of the global population will not be able to adapt and survive. There will be pockets, I think, of people. You know, some of the wealthier countries, you know, that have martial law and prevent, still able to grow some food, you know, can try to get by. But it's not going to be a pleasant world. There's no doubt about that. You know, how many people it affects. I mean, everybody on the planet will be affected, but how many people, you know, what is it? Like it's just going to be a complete breakdown of what we see. It's going to be a state change or a phase shift or just something unrecognizable to what we have now. So,
Paul, I want to follow up with you. One area that we don't seem to hear enough about, though you alluded to it twice today, is methane released from the northern permafrost. We don't even know where the tundra regions are. If you were to go out on the street in front of Columbia University and ask the average student, could you show me on a map where the tundra is? What do you want to bet most couldn't? And yet it comprises 20% of the land in the northern hemisphere, mostly Siberia and northern Greenland and large expanses of the Canadian Northern Territories. Now, this year and last year, Siberia has been posting some of the warmest years on record, as much as 6 degrees Celsius higher in some parts of Siberia in 2015. And the EPA says that methane is 8,400% more potent than CO2 and it is more efficient in trapping radiation than CO2. And while CO2 continues to be the primary molecule contributing to warming, and much of the methane produced is from livestock, and we don't seem to be reducing our desire for meat, and there's no national world campaign, especially in the developing nations who are developing to keep up with us. They want what we have. If we have cars, they want cars. If we eat meat, they want the meat. So instead of saying, hold on, these are finite resources and we shouldn't have been using in the first place, let's keep the oil and gas in the ground, let's go to a plant-based diet. Look at Brazil, look at India, look at Russia, and look at China as examples of when their economy prospered and they had a new, educated, upper-middle class. They wanted everything we have. And they've gotten a lot of what we have. They've gotten obesity, diabetes, this epidemic in India. They have cancers they didn't have before in the same percentages. But if you ask them about if you got rid of cattle and pigs, you're getting rid of methane, a lot of it. If you stop buying everything you don't need, and you stop buying things that do not biodegrade, like the plastics, if you demand that those fleshlights and batteries and everything else you buy that have super concealed, you know, super contained plastic, it would help the world, you get a shrug. So tell us about, are there models that are especially alarming in this scenario that we should be made aware of, since most people in the world will not voluntarily change anything?
Yes, the methane is the biggest concern that I have. We've seen a rise in global concentrations of methane since about a big uptick rise since about 2007. And if you go to the Arctic, we've seen a very, very large rise in methane levels in the atmosphere above the Arctic because the major sources of the permafrost, which is frozen ground, is thawing, and all the organic matter that's in the permafrost is being decomposed by bacteria. And if it's right at the surface and there's lots of oxygen, like right near the ground surface, then it will produce CO2. But if it's in a swamp or under a bit of water, not much oxygen, then it will produce the methane. And as you said, methane is 84 times more potent than CO2. That's over a 20-year time scale. But if you talk about a 1 or 2 year time scale, it's more like 150 to 200 times more potent on a molecule, on a mass basis compared to CO2. And yet the number that I hear all the time in the public, from mainstream media, even from scientists, I hear 24, 25 times worse than CO2. And even that number is wrong. That number is based on a 100-year time scale. And it's actually the latest IPCC report gives the number of 34, and yet the media just doesn't seem to pick up. They're so ingrained. That number is so embedded in their psyche that, you know, methane, it's 24, 25 times worse. Well, it's not. That number is wrong. It's 34 times, even in the best case of 100, if you average it over 100 years, which makes absolutely no sense because methane only lasts for about 10, 11, 12 years in the atmosphere. But then the lifetime of methane in the atmosphere depends on the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, which generates this hydroxyl ion, which is like the scavenger, and it cleans out the chemicals in the atmosphere. So it reacts with methane, OH-, reacts with methane producing CO2, but the Arctic is very dry. There's almost no water vapor in the air. It's very cold. Cold air doesn't hold much water vapor. So methane in the Arctic will last a lot longer. So the methane that is coming up, and it's not just in the summer when the ice is melting back, it's in the winter as well. And there's huge amounts. And over, if you look at even the last 3 or 4 years, the levels of methane in the atmosphere have risen some huge number, something like 30 parts per billion per year at all different levels in the atmosphere. And compared to the range of methane was about 350 to 700 parts per billion over the last million years. And now it's three times, even four times that much in parts of the Arctic, which we're measuring from satellites. So the pockmarks, the big craters in Siberia, are methane class rates that are heating up, and the methane is released and expands, and it creates pressure under the ground, and it's blowing these big, huge chunks of Earth out, creating these craters. And we've seen 20 or 30 of these craters in Siberia. You know, we'll start seeing these in Alaska, too. We're also seeing these on the ocean floor. And on the ocean floor, it's a bit different. Like, the gas pressure pushes up a vast part of the ocean floor. And we've seen regions like a kilometer in diameter where the Earth is being pushed up on the ocean floor in the Kara Sea on the continental shelf, for example. So we're playing with fire, literally, with methane. Off New Zealand, in very shallow waters, there's these enormous pockmarks on the ocean floor, 100, 150 kilometers in diameter. And we think that those were created in the past, deep past, by a methane expulsion. And if we get a similar event happening now, we're talking about global average temperature rising, you know, from 1 year to the next, like a huge amount. I mean, that 5 or 6 degrees is possible. In some paleo records, we saw a temperature rise of 5 degrees Celsius in 13 years, and this is captured in some sediment records. So we know that the Earth can respond very, very quickly. We know that these things can happen, and people are just completely oblivious. The general public is completely oblivious to these risks. So this is why I'm advocating that we need to try to cool the Arctic to keep the methane in place while we slash emissions and while we remove CO2 from the atmosphere.
Thank you for that answer, Paul. Professor Paul Beckwith from Ottawa, Canada there. And now let's go back over to Professor Guy McPherson, who's in New Mexico. Guy, the question that is likely on many people's minds is, what can we do? Should they only focus upon their personal survival, or is greater activism in order, which would require a different kind of awakening than running away from catastrophe and believing that they can somewhere find safety and solace? And as recent research shows, when people enter a mindset of helplessness and a loss of hope, they tend to become complacent, less active, more self-centered, and only seek what self-gratification they can find in the moment. So what do you say to these people to get their attention, both in the honest evaluation of what life is likely to be for the average person? And if you could give us that scenario, because again, when people are hearing the oceans warming, the tundra, they don't associate with that. But give them an idea of what some of the consequences could be if you're just a person living in the United States, even though this program is broadcast all over the world. We'll use that just as an example. And then what would you suggest for those people to do?
Well, we unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, cannot predict the future with great accuracy. So my message and my suggestion is the same as it's been for a long time, which is to take actions that people believe will be beneficial for them, regardless of what happens in the future. So abundant evidence indicates that we're going to run out of habitat for human animals in the not very distant future. So what to do about that? I would argue the same thing that you thought was right to do before, including, for example, if you're concerned about what you put in your mouth, growing food, or knowing the person who does grow your food, know where your food comes from, know what kinds of conditions it was subjected to. The same applies to your water. There's only a very few things that humans need, not merely to survive, but to thrive on this planet. There are things like taking care of the air, so I'd be pretty careful about living right next to a coal-fired power plant or right next to a nuclear power plant. We have some control over the water we drink, and one of the reasons I live off-grid and have two wells on this property to provide the water is because the water is really, really high quality. Growing food is the third item. Maintaining your body temperature is the fourth, and interacting with, becoming part of a decent and perhaps even loving human community. Those are the five things we have some control over, and that I would argue that you should attend to regardless of what you see on the horizon. And for the truly bleak scenarios that are on the horizon. The latter of those, your immersion into a decent human community, couldn't be more important. How you spend your time and with whom you spend your time, those are the important things that you're going to take with you into next week and next month and next year and into your grave, is who you spent the time with and how you spent that time.
I'd like to address that in a little different perspective. For a number of years, I've seen what has happened to society. Being a farmer, being a certified organic farmer and a beekeeper for my entire life, adult life, I've seen what happens when you live in balance with nature. I've also seen people who sprayed the neonicotinoids and their bees are gone. Complete colony collapse. Now we're seeing that on a larger scale. And when you consider one-third of all bees, one-third of all vegetables and fruits and nuts come from pollination, we're not talking about something that's trivial. I see people. Now, concerning the first point you made, we need water, we need clean water, healthy water, you have it. I believe that that's very important because there are lots of places in America where you can get clean, healthy water from aquifers. You can get your own wells, and that's a major, major positive. Then we need healthy food. You can't get that from livestock, so you give up the animal-based diet and you go towards a healthy plant-based diet, organic and sustainable. I grew up where my great-aunt ran her own farm and took care of almost 20 relatives during the Great Depression, the entirety of the Great Depression. She was a little wiry woman, and she was a vegan, and she was a disciplinarian, so nobody liked her because they couldn't get away with anything. But when I got to an age where I could visit her in Little Hocking, Ohio, I remember she showed how to do things like drying apricots, peaches, nectarines, and apples, and on screens, putting up this muslin cloth over it so you wouldn't have the insects getting it. And after 4 days of turning them over, they were dry. She put them in barrels. We don't do that today. In one of her underground cellars, she had over 200 of these big wooden barrels, the type that you know you see a wine made in or alcohol. And she had every kind of grain and legume, pulse and seed, and tuber. And she would take apples, and she had a way of melting honey and then dipping these apples in the honey so the honey coated it, so the honey, dipping it in wax, beeswax, and so the apples wouldn't shrink. And she could keep an apple for a long period of time. And I said, why are you doing that? And she said, during the Great Depression, your father, meaning my father, and his siblings came from a background of complete incompetence. And I'm thinking, whoa, because they couldn't do anything. They didn't have to. They had everything done for them. Someone was always doing something. Someone grew their food. They didn't. Someone made their clothes. They didn't. Someone fixed the electric, the plumbing. And she said, I just believe in being able to do everything for myself or with your Uncle Johnny, who lives there. And therefore, if times get tough, we can do it all ourselves. And I was young when she said that, and it didn't make an impact on me at that time. But boy, does it today, because she had what quite simply was the ideal homestead. And today, I believe that we should be looking at our lives and saying, if I have a plan A and B, where would I want to be? Where would be the ideal location I could survive? And to your statement about having a conscious community, that's the challenging part, and I'll tell you why. A lot of people would love to do homesteading projects. I've had probably 5,000 to 10,000 come to lectures on homesteading I've done in New York City. How many actually then have the resources, not just the financial resources, but the emotional resources to take that risk to do something where you don't know the outcome, and therefore all that could be dark and wrong within your own development and maladaptive behavior is going to come forward and be an impediment. Or you're just not the right person. We have a lot of people in our society who are parasites. I've met them. They love to live off other people. They're ingratiating. They're somewhat charming. But at the end of the day, you find you're doing everything for them. So you got to be really careful. You don't want people who are damaged merchandise coming into your environment, or all the time, instead of being on quality of life, as you mentioned, that doesn't take a lot, is spent on, you know, trying to rescue someone from themselves, and that never works. That is the biggest impediment. But once you find the people, and there are a lot of good people who have got their life together, and you decide upon harmonizing certain qualities, then you can have shared quality of life, each one in their own way, each contributing something, and everybody's got something to contribute. And then I think you're looking at the future for those who choose to pay attention. But most people, it is my experience, when met with a challenge, a crisis, will implode. They do not know how to use the crisis as a way of learning, growing, and exceeding the limitation. Your thoughts, please.
I absolutely couldn't agree more. You know, we have a global economic depression about every three generations worldwide. And that's so long between them that the generation doesn't remember. And so this idea of taking care of oneself and taking care of one's neighbors gets lost in the shuffle because we've experienced good times. And I see the same thing happening today with an entire generation of young people who think it's absurd that we would focus on self-reliance when everything I need can be ordered with my smartphone and I can go pick it up with fiat currency. And that's the way the world has always been.
Does that include intelligence, wisdom, and survival skills? They can pick that up somewhere? Because
right,
they don't
exactly.
have it. This generation, Guy, they're not going to make it. You're aware of that, right?
Absolutely. Of course.
Yeah.
I mean,
their idea is if they hit the Titanic, quick, Twitter everybody, go to your stateroom and lock yourself in, and we'll communicate and text each other. Not the best idea.
The first significant conversation I had with my mother-in-law shortly after I got married, and my parents-in-law were familiar with the Great Depression. The first significant conversation I had with her as I was working on my PhD was, do you know how to grow your own food? Do you know how to do this? Do you know how to do that? Because she didn't care that I was about to get a PhD. She couldn't care less what kind of education I had, unless it was an education in reality. And, you know, that memory was still fresh enough with her that she was concerned about the ability to provide food for her daughter, with her daughter. So it's just that we have so long between these kinds of economic events that there's no cultural motivation to participate in what we're doing here, which is developing a homestead with shallow water and the ability to grow food and on and on. It's just absurd. When I moved here, many of my academic colleagues from various states concluded that I was insane, that I had some sort of rare brain disorder that caused me to leave a high-paying, not very work-intensive job to come out and start growing food. So that's the sort of mentality that we're up against.
But look at what happens today. Just take a pull back for a moment. And Paul, I want you to address this as well.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd like both of you to address this. You have to pull back and look at everything that is interconnected. Right now we have 275 million Americans who are struggling. Over 55 million on are food insecure. We have 3.5 million people living on $2 or less a day. We have 18 million hungry children in the United States. We have 1.6 million homeless children who go to school and don't have a home to go to. We have 32 million Americans who've lost their home and are couch surfing or staying with a relative or a friend because they at least know someone, but otherwise they would be on the street or in a shelter. We have a government that has abrogated all responsibility to these people, and it started with Bill Clinton and his evisceration of the welfare program. We also have corporations that seek their profit, but not a living wage for their employees. So you have this enormous disparity. Then you see that the United States has nothing to back up its fiat currency, and right now we are the world leader in debt. Between corporate debt, $26 trillion, state debt, $5 trillion. No state except for one has been able to balance their budget. And you have the unfunded and underfunded entitlements. You have student debt, $1.2 trillion, credit card debt, $900 billion, mortgage debt, $16 billion. You add all this up and you say, and exactly how is we supposed to pay this? And the answer is you can't. But if any other country couldn't pay their debt and was just spending, 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 someone would say that's irresponsible. And we say, but we have the alchemy on our side, so debt is an asset. Well, not if you owe against it. It is not. It is a debt. And we don't even have the nomenclature right. So now you have a global economy that is now in contraction. You have oil that has fallen, and the Middle East is in crisis, both through wars in Yemen, where there's over 18 Arab nations fighting on behalf of the Sunnis and the radical form of Islam, which is Wahhabism, against the Shia. You have drought. You had 123,000 extreme weather events just in the last 12 months. And yet, with the environment coming down in different places where no one thought that their home would be wiped away, look at Northern England in the last 3 months has had over 67 days of straight rain. Homes that had never been flooded in the history of the village, 100 years old, are now flooded and unsafe to go back to. Mold is a major problem. And so you look at all this together, the environment, our health is failing, our medical system is failing, people cannot afford health. But of course, they don't pay attention to this. We have no one guiding us. We have literally no one who has a pact with the people. Instead, they have compromised themselves to special interest groups. So the environment's gone to hell. Our food supply is genetically engineered. Our politic is bought out by Citizens United and totally corrupt. We have sociopaths running the government. We have syncopaths and technocrats running the media, giving us only the corporate story. We have oligarchy, and we have a police state. Now, am I missing something, or are we supposed to have a happy outcome to all this? I'd like both of you to give us your closing arguments on this, please.
Well, ask people what they're most worried about, and how many people in the U.S. will answer terrorism, which you didn't mention at all, really, in all of these other things. I mean, the people just, like, there's more chance of being killed by a toddler, you know, grabbing a mother's gun in her purse or something than by terrorism, or having a vending machine fall on you. The risk of that is greater, dying from that in the U.S. than from terrorism. So part of it is the misguided, people just don't assess risk properly. And I ask you, the U.S. military says that climate change is the biggest threat now. I mean, this came out in Davos, this came out in Paris. There's a report, the U.S. military report, and they talk about climate as changes the threat multiplier. And yet, if this is all true, then we have an entire party in the U.S., the Republican Party, which is denying the existence of climate change. I mean, things are just maybe it's just me, but I mean, things are just totally and utterly like unbalanced and crazy. I mean, maybe Guantanamo should be converted to a climate change school and send all of the climate deniers there for a month until they come out and realize, you know, what's going on with climate change. like all this denial.
I would agree
problem.
With that only if
How
you gave every politician in Washington and the Justice Department and all 17 security agencies an enhanced interrogation educational program on climate change.
Yeah, yes, that would be a good start. So everybody at least recognizes the reality of the situation and the reality of the risks that are there, not make-believe risks, right? I'm not saying, you know, terrorism isn't a problem, but when you look at the number of, I mean, climate change can kill billions of people, and it can do it in decades. You know, if we go through an abrupt change and we can no longer grow food, I mean, it is a threat. But, you know, it's and the military is coming out and saying, yes, it's the biggest threat that is facing us. So meanwhile, we're spending $700 billion in the U.S. on military stuff. How, you know, if climate change is a threat, how about spending that money for a couple of years on finding out how to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, do it quickly, how to have a Manhattan-scale project to renewables, stop burning fossil fuels completely, figure out how to cool the Arctic, for example, because of the methane threat. Like, you know, I'm hoping that one day I'll wake up and there'll be sort of sanity returned, but, you know, I'm not holding my breath on that.
Okay. Thank you. Now, Guy, quick final closing comments, please.
Yeah, it's so much worse than you pointed out, Gary. It really is. Everything is... There is apparently no willingness by almost anybody in the society to take responsibility for themselves and for their neighbors. There's complete capitulation to the corporate government and to the corporations as if they have our best interests in mind. So I would disagree with Paul on one point. I think terrorism is a big deal, and I think it's a big deal because the Pentagon created it. The Pentagon is now asking for $7.5 billion, this is a headline from today, $7.5 billion to fight ISIS. Most people don't know that the Pentagon created ISIS. So now they're asking money for $7.5 billion to fight a threat they created. Terrorism is a big deal because of our actions that create terrorists. So if you're looking to the government or to the corporations to improve your life or to make any part of the situation better, you're looking in the wrong place. The place to look is within you and within your community and the people around you. If you can create a decent set of living arrangements with the people around you, a trusting relationship based on people taking responsibility, then I think that's the only way you're going to have a better future than the recent past you may have enjoyed.
I absolutely agree with that. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Paul Beckwith. Thank you, Professor Guy McPherson. And the book is Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, which, by the way, has an outstanding foreword by Andrew Harvey, a must-read. The program is Nature Bats Last, every Tuesday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network and paulbeckwith.net. I'm Gary Nault. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.